From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It was a big week for Alex Rodriguez. He became the seventh and youngest member of baseball's 600 home run club, and then he learned he'd be getting the $24 million the Texas Rangers owe him. Ahead on Only a Game, all the latest baseball news, also a WNBA roundup, and a spin around the hardwood with unicyclists who dunk, drive, and dribble on one thin wheel. Also, the story of the pitcher who got snubbed by the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, only to get picked up by the Negro League.
In fact, I'm so proud and I'm so glad that they didn't let me try out, because I wouldn't be here. I would be just another lady ball player somewhere. But now I'm proud to say I'm the only and the first lady Major League pitcher.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Randy Newman said and sang it years ago, "Oh, Baltimore, ain't it hard just to live?" And it has been this summer, if the local baseball team is your life. The Orioles have lost twice as often as they've won. No major league team has been less successful. And so I won't ask ESPN's Tim Kirkjian to talk about the Orioles, because it would just be a sad way to begin the program. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Bill. Actually, it would be a good way to begin the program, because Buck Showalter, the new manager there, is now the first manager in the history of baseball to take over a team that's at least 30 games under 500 and win his first three games with that team.
How about that? Are we looking at a trend here? I mean, is it going to be good times in Baltimore from here on out?
I don't think so, but he is going to change the culture with his attention to detail. One quick story. He goes into his new office in Baltimore, and right over his desk is a picture of, like, the first game played at Camden Yards. And somebody said, "How do you like that picture?" And he looks at it and goes, "I hate it." And they said, "Why?" He said, "Well, look, the other team has the bases loaded. They're going to score some runs. We're in trouble in this picture. I'm taking this picture down." And the next day, he took it down.
Tim, before we get too far into the standings, let's talk a little bit about this week's auction of the Texas Rangers after a marathon bidding session that started Wednesday and finally ended early Thursday morning. Nolan Ryan and his group emerged as the new owners, pending Major League approval. Are Ryan et al. Better for the Rangers than Mark Cuban and his group would have been?
Yes, I think so. And that's not to say Mark Cuban wouldn't be a good owner. I would love to see baseball take a run at him, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. The point is, though, that Nolan Ryan is much better suited to be a part of this group, because he's Nolan Ryan. I lived in Dallas-Fort Worth for 10 years, and I can't even begin to tell you how popular he is in that area. And if his group had not gotten the team, then he would not be with the Rangers anymore. And that would have been a major blow to them from a PR standpoint, but also from a baseball standpoint, because I think he's had at least something to do with the turnaround of the Rangers this year, because he walks into that room where there are a bunch of pitchers, they all pay attention, and he says, "Boys, we're going to do it a little bit better this year." And for his 2 years there, they've done it a lot better on the mound.
And I can see Nolan Ryan walking into the locker room and saying to the pitchers, "Boys, I want you to throw 105 miles an hour. What do you think?"
You know, Nolan stood on the top step of the dugout after like a 9-game losing streak many years ago. And before he went out for the top of the first inning, he looked at his teammates and said, "Boys, this stops right here." And then he went out and threw like a 2-hitter and struck out 15. Typical Nolan Ryan.
One of the people happiest to see the Rangers emerge from federal bankruptcy protection is former Ranger Alex Rodriguez, who is still owed almost $25 million in deferred compensation by the team. He also hit his 600th home run on Wednesday. Good week for him, wouldn't you say?
I would say, and it's about time he hit one, because it was getting a little tiresome, because that was the story every day. You know, this is a really tricky story, Bill, because seven guys now in baseball history have hit 600 home runs out of roughly 17,000 that have played in the major league. So we have to give this guy credit for what he's done. And yet, given his admission of using PEDs for 3 years in Texas, clearly there wasn't the same buzz about this, nor was there the same buzz because four guys have reached the 600 home run club in the last 10 years when only three guys made it up until 10 years ago.
On Monday, the Cincinnati Reds will begin a three-game homestand against the St. Louis Cardinals. This is a matchup of the top two teams in the National League Central, at least for the time being. The Reds are having a very successful season with a roster of relative unknowns. How are they doing it?
Well, they're doing it with an offense that I did not see being this good, not even close. But Scott Rolen has had a great year. Johnny Gomes, their left fielder, has done a very nice job. Joey Votto, until he got hurt recently, was on his way, I thought, to becoming the MVP of the National League. Plus, they've got pitcher after pitcher after pitcher coming from their minor league system. It began with Mike Leake, who never even pitched in the minor leagues, came straight from college to the big leagues. He's 7-3. He's been tremendous. And now Aroldis Chapman, the kid they signed out of Cuba and gave $30 million to, we'll see him before this season's over also.
The San Diego Padres are on top of the National League West. Have fans noticed, or are things totally mellow at the Murph? Excuse me, placid at the Petco?
No, people have noticed there, and they've noticed that I picked the Padres to finish last in the division, and they are going to finish first in the division. How am I looking right now?
You just turned it upside down. It's a mistake anybody could have made.
Bill, look at their lineup someday and tell me, how do they win? It's an amazing story what they're doing, and it just shows you again, when you have a bunch of young, hungry kids who can really pitch and can really catch the ball, you always have a chance.
Who else should we be paying some attention to at this point, Tim?
One thing we've got to keep our eye on, sadly, is how many managers are on their last legs here. I count 8, maybe 9, maybe even 10 managers from here that might not be back next year. Is Joe Torre coming back with the Dodgers? Bobby Cox is retiring. Cito Gasson's retiring. Lou Piniella has already announced he's retiring. 2, 3, 4 other managers could be fired before this season's over. It's been a very tumultuous year for managers, and it just goes to show you how difficult this job is to do this today. It's way harder than it's ever been, and I wrote that story earlier this year. I got a text from A.J. Hinch, the manager of the Diamondbacks, saying, I really appreciate your take on how difficult it is to manage today, and 2 hours later, he got fired.
Tim Kirkchin is a reporter for ESPN's Baseball Tonight, a senior writer for ESPN the magazine, an author as well, and according to Charlie Pierce, one of the best pickup basketball players working in the sports media world today. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
Mamie Peanut Johnson pitched from 1953 to 1955. She was one of only three females to play baseball in the Negro League. As Rebecca Shear reports from WAMU in Washington, the field near Capitol Hill, where Johnson was discovered, could soon bear the name of the first and only woman ever to pitch in the Negro League.
Mamie Peanut Johnson loves sharing the story of how she earned her nickname. It was 1953, her first season pitching for the Indianapolis Clowns.
The young man that I was playing ball against, he said I wasn't big as a peanut. How did I expect to strike anybody out? So I struck him out, and that's where it came from.
With thick, horn-rimmed glasses perched on her nose, a red, white, and blue clown's cap perched on her head, the petite 75-year-old is sitting in the lobby outside D.C. City Council chambers. She's getting ready to testify on a bill that would name a baseball field a stone's throw from her childhood house, the Mamie Peanut Johnson Field.
This ball field is where I was really discovered from to go to the black major leagues.
Which was an exciting moment for her, she says.
Because I always played with the boys.
She was like Skinny Minnie. But when she played with the boys, the fellas in the community, wherever they hit the ball, trust me, she would catch the ball in the outfield.
Rosalie Smith attended elementary and junior high school with Johnson in the 1940s.
And she could hit a ball, too. So the guys in the neighborhood didn't have nothing on her, trust me. She was good. She was good.
But longtime friend Jerome Gray recalls the attribute for which Johnson was to be remembered.
Of course, she was small in stature, but she had a good pitching arm. The members of the Negro Baseball League came down to watch her play, and they were very impressed.
So within 48 hours of being discovered on that field in D.C., Mamie Peanut Johnson was signed on as a pitcher with the Indianapolis Clowns. The first of her three seasons, she played alongside this guy.
My name is Pedro Sierra. I played with her 1 year, and then the other 3 years, I was with a different team in Detroit, with the Detroit Stars. But, you know, we were in the same league.
Sierra, who immigrated from Cuba when he was 16, says Johnson was like a sister to the guys on the team.
We protected her, and she looked after us, and, you know, down the line, that's the way it goes.
Did she hold her own? I mean, you know, she was a little thing. She was a little peanut. Did she hold her own out there on the field?
She was qualified and very determined and very smart.
All of which made for quite the winning combination, as D.C. Council Chair Vincent Gray points out inside council chambers during the hearing for the ball field bill.
Well, it was a 33-8 record that she had. And I bet you if you go back and look at some of the people she struck out, they were people who were considered some of the best baseball players ever to step on the field at the time. They probably didn't want to admit that she struck them out.
When Gray talks about the best players, he's referring to people like Lonnie Harris and Buck O'Neill, both of whom faced Johnson. Johnson received guidance from the great Satchel Paige, who had left the Negro League by 1950. She explains meeting with him in this 2003 interview with NPR.
He was kind enough to help me to perfect the curveball. I knew how to throw it, but the technique that he gave me helped me so much. I was able to strike a whole lot of fellas out there.
But before Johnson's successes on the Negro League field, as an African-American woman, she faced her share of challenges. When she was 17, she brought a friend to tryouts for the all-white, all-American girls professional baseball league, the one featured in the movie A League of Their Own.
They didn't let us try out. They just looked at us like we were crazy, as if to say, what do you want?
A year later, Johnson was playing pro ball with the boys.
And in fact, I'm so proud and I'm so glad that they didn't let me try out, because I wouldn't be here doing what I'm doing now. I would be just another lady ball player somewhere. But now I'm proud to say I'm the only and the first lady major league pitcher.
That's why, back at D.C. Council Chambers, sports fan Michael Ackerstein says Johnson serves as a powerful role model for young African-American women.
As well as anyone else trying to succeed in a field not historically dominated by members of the race or gender. Her story really is something that inspires anyone.
And Council Chair Vincent Gray agrees. The council still must vote on the bill that would name the local ball field after Johnson, but Gray says he has a hunch how it'll go.
I have a sense, too, of what an enormous accomplishment it was for you to be able to walk out there and do what you did. So I want to take the if out of this. I think it's a win, W-H-E-N, and there will be a win, W-I-N, for you when this happens.
But as Mamie Peanut Johnson says in her testimony, she's already won now that this bill is bringing her story to light.
And it's a good thing for this to happen, because young people will know that they can do anything.
Be it following a dream, breaking a barrier, or, yes, striking out a burly baseball player when you're no bigger than a peanut. For Only a Game, I'm Rebecca Shear in Washington.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Paintball is supposed to offer participants the opportunity to shoot each other without dangerous consequences. The Big Sky paintball course on the side of a ski hill in Montana might have succeeded at that, except that in an attempt to make the paintballs environmentally friendly, the proprietors filled the balls with a vegetable oil which turned out to be irresistible to bears. Some of the grizzlies and black bears that roam the region began showing up for paintball parties of their own, and wildlife officials have said some of those bears ate unexploded paintballs, which encouraged the owners of the facility to shut it down until somebody can find a paintball filling that bears don't like. I wonder if that will require convening a taste-testing panel of bears.
But right behind me was that bear, and so I ran away from there. And right behind me was that bear.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Hoopsters on Hot Wheels, or Hot Wheel, actually. But first, a quick look at the WNBA standings might lead you to conclude that in the Western Conference, the Seattle Storm have already begun resting their regulars in preparation for the postseason, while every team in the East is still scrambling for position. Joining me now to discuss that circumstance and others related to the WNBA is Clay Callum, correspondent for Full Court Press. Clay, welcome back to the program.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, Bill. Always good to be on.
On Tuesday night, the Seattle Storm, winners of over 80% of their games, lost to the Tulsa Shock, losers of about 80% of their games. So, were the Storm's regulars resting?
Not really. Lauren Jackson, who's probably the best player in the world right now, had just hurt her thumb and wasn't very effective. But it's very difficult in any sport to maintain a high level of efficiency for an entire season. And that, I think, is Seattle's biggest challenge. I mean, you go 22-2, what else is there to prove? And you have to keep that momentum going, and it's really very difficult.
Well, the second-best record in the West belongs to Phoenix. They're about a 500 team, so is Seattle a lock for the finals?
No. They struggled to beat Connecticut on Thursday. And Phoenix, though the record is 13-13, they've lost a bunch of close games, and statistics say that close games you should go about 50-50 because they're really decided by luck. And according to the statistical gurus, Phoenix's record actually should probably be closer to 16-10 than it is to 13-13. They have four great players. That's not a lock. That's going to be one of the best postseason series, assuming Seattle and Phoenix advance to the Western Conference Finals.
In the East, nobody has played well enough to clinch a playoff spot, and nobody has played badly enough to disappear from contention. Is this sort of parity good for the game, or does it just mean all the teams are mediocre?
it's the glass half full. I think what we're seeing, though, that is sort of the impact of contraction. The league is down to 12 teams. Everybody has a bunch of good players. It's very difficult to make a roster in the league. It's very difficult to find minutes. And these teams are all very solid teams. They can win on the road. They can win at home. They have talent. And if you don't bring your A game, you're going to lose. There's just a bunch of talent. And then again, the Eastern teams have gone out west here in the last couple weeks, and they're not dominating anymore because the Western teams are getting a little healthier. Things are tough in the WNBA. There's no gimmies anywhere.
I saw that last weekend President Obama and his daughter took in a Mystics game in D.C. Any indication that his presence has made WNBA games the place to be seen?
Well, probably not if you're a conservative, but I would doubt that. I mean, I think it's nice that he went. I think that's a great thing for the league that the president comes, brings his daughter, and they watch the game. That's a wonderful thing. But in the long run, really what's going to determine the success of the WNBA is good basketball on the floor that makes fans want to come back.
Clay, the WNBA, like most leagues, markets itself by focusing on the stars. And one of the WNBA's biggest stars, Diana Taurasi of the Phoenix Mercury, is talking about taking next season off due to overwork. Define overwork in Ms. Taurasi's case.
Well, it's not just Diana. The women's basketball situation is odd. The big money is made in Europe in the winter season, the traditional basketball season. So Diana Taurasi, for example, will make $500,000 playing. I believe she's in Turkey this coming year. She's been in Russia in the past few years. Now, she can only make $100,000 in the WNBA. But what's ironic is that your European salary is determined by your performance in the WNBA. So the players have to play year-round. They have to play in the WNBA to establish their credentials in Europe, and then in Europe, that's where they make their money. Hmm. So look for Taurasi, for example, to maybe miss a month of the season or miss a month in Europe and take a little less money here and there to try to elongate her career. But it's a serious problem, no question, and there's no easy, obvious answer for it.
Clay, a couple of weeks ago, we had a story about former Olympian and performance-enhancing drug user Marion Jones, who has embarked on a career in the WNBA under Nolan Richardson's tutelage. How's she doing?
To be kind, it was a publicity stunt from day one. I've talked to, indirectly heard from people who are in the training camp, and they say, yeah, she is a great athlete. There's absolutely no question. But she's just not a basketball player. She hasn't played for longer than 10 years, and she's 34 years old. She's in the league to sell tickets, not to play basketball. Tulsa is 5-22, and she can't get off the bench.
Okay, Clay, here comes the customary end of the conversation question. Seattle, as we have said, has been the class of the West and the league in general this season. Can any team come out of the East to beat the Storm for all the marbles later this summer?
Oh, I think so, but I wouldn't discount Phoenix. It certainly would not surprise me to see Phoenix playing in the WNBA Finals. And if you look at the East right now, I think Indiana certainly has shown some ability to win. They're a strong defensive team. Atlanta has done some nice things. Washington, if Lindsey Harding recovers from her twisted ankle, could be very good. But I think the two teams that have the best chance are Atlanta and Indiana. But in truth, neither of them has the depth and of talent that Seattle has, nor do they have the depth of talent that Phoenix has. They'll have to win with defense and team play, whereas Seattle and Phoenix can just sort of out-talent you.
Clay Callum has been covering women's basketball since 1996, and he joins me from time to time to talk about it. Thanks, Clay.
Thank you, Bill. Always a pleasure.
In January, an upstart basketball team out of Berkeley, California, placed second in the 15th World Unicycling Convention and Championships, or Unicon 15. France took the title, but some say that's because prohibitive favorite Puerto Rico couldn't make it to the New Zealand competition. This past July, the Berkeley team played host to the North American Unicycle Basketball Championships, at which powerhouse Puerto Rico was present. Only a Game's Andrew Stelzer was there to witness what appears to be an international one-wheeled rivalry in the making.
The Berkeley High School gym is supposed to be quiet. After all, school's out for the summer. But instead, the entire school campus has been overrun by hundreds of people riding unicycles. The unicycling hotbed of Puerto Rico has brought a 30-person contingent out to California. Even though the basketball tourney is still 6 days away, the Puerto Rican All-Stars, as their team is known, are oozing with confidence.
We are going to win.
We're going to win. They're going to lose. We're going to win. We're the best.
We're going to win this week. We're going to win tomorrow and always.
Yesmar Delgado is the president of the Puerto Rican Unicycle Federation. He says he's heard Berkeley has some good players, but his team is not too concerned. After all, Berkeley has only been playing as a team for about 3 years.
Well, the Berkeley team sent us a video to Puerto Rico so that we could see that they're practicing. It makes us very happy to know that they're practicing, they're preparing, they're motivated. But we're going to face them here. And it's like we say in Puerto Rico, here is where what has been learned is demonstrated.
Those videos, tools of intimidation perhaps, featured clips of the Unicon tournament in New Zealand. In their first ever appearance at the World Championship Games, Berkeley lost in the finals to a team from France.
It was the first time we'd ever really played against another top-level team.
That's Tom Holub, starting forward for the Berkeley Unicycle basketball team, nicknamed the Berkeley Revolution.
We actually were getting good shots. We were working our offense. But then when we actually were taking shots, we weren't getting our bodies controlled and shooting with form, so we missed a lot of shots. We turned the ball over too much, and then we lost a lot of points on transition defense.
If that sounds like regular basketball, that's because it is. Unicycle basketball rules are almost exactly the same, with a few minor tweaks. Instead of 3 seconds in the lane, the limit is 4. It only took tournament organizer and Berkeley Revolution player Lance Thornton about 5 minutes to explain the differences as the teams gathered before the first day's round-robin series of games.
So when you're on the unicycle and you're riding, you dribble, right? If you hold it and you pedal more than 1.5 rotations, it's a travel. Is this legal?
Thornton bounces up and down on his unicycle.
If you hop with the ball, it's equivalent to doing this with the ball, which is a travel in basketball.
Watching the games, it's pretty difficult to tell when someone's wheel has gone more than 1.5 rotations. It's actually pretty surprising that they can stay more or less in one spot in the first place. That's called idling, and it's absolutely key to being a good unicyclist and thus a good uni-basketball player.
For me, I've been riding 3 months. I still don't know how to do that. So on defense, I'm a liability because I have to keep circling back around. I got to make constant circles. So I can't actually stay with my man if he's standing still or riding still.
That's Joshua Matenko. The Berkeley Revolution call him Coach Mo. Although Mo still isn't good enough to play with the team, every member of the Revolution credits him with helping turn them into a cohesive unit.
Yeah. Good job, defense. Keep talking. Man on. Watch right. Go, go, go.
The Revolution breezes through several lopsided victories in the round robin. But then, in their last game before a showdown with powerhouse Puerto Rico, a collision leads to an injury of sorts.
Man, what's Tom going to do for a uni?
Lance Thornton has a look of concern.
I was flying down the court to go around and play defense, and we didn't see each other. Tom cut in front of me, and I just plowed right into his unicycle.
So it broke like 4 spokes, and therefore the wheel doesn't fit in the frame anymore. It's fixable, but I don't have spoke nipples here.
Without his spoke nipples to make repairs, Tom Holub has to use his backup unicycle, the one he first learned to ride almost 10 years ago. It's heavier than some of today's lightweight titanium models, but the game must go on.
Viva la Revolution!
Apparently, the Revolution's practice has paid off, and they easily handle Puerto Rico 15-8 in a tense game that's neck and neck until late in the second half. Most frustrating for the Puerto Rican All-Stars is that coach and star player Charles Perez hurt himself the first day of the U Games and wasn't able to play.
I can't do anything. I see the team playing and I can't play. It's sad. I was very excited. I had been practicing for almost a year for this tournament, but that's the way life goes.
Still, Coach Perez is confident, and all eyes are on Berkeley and Puerto Rico once again the following night, as both teams have cruised through to the Final Four.
All the way down to Zuli, she's open, she shoots, and scores!
Berkeley overwhelms the Puerto Rican B team 22-8, and the Puerto Rican All-Stars win handily over a surprisingly good squad from Minnesota, meaning the championship game, as expected, pits the Revolution versus Puerto Rico. There are two previously unseen Puerto Rican players on the court, leading some to believe that they were saving their secret weapons for the finals. But this one isn't even close. Berkeley takes a lead early on and never looks back. The hometown crowd, most of whom have never been to a unicycle basketball game, feeds the confidence of a team that's passing well, playing solid D, and making the easy shots.
The North American Unicycle Basketball Champions are the Berkeley Revolution!
The final score is 47-29, and North America has a new champion. Revolution team member Lance Thornton says this is only the beginning.
Feels great. So excited. Maybe in a couple years in Italy, we'll take the world. Big dreams.
Clearly, a rematch is on the horizon. The next Unicon World Championships are in Bressanone, Italy in 2012. For Only a Game, I'm Andrew Stelzer in Berkeley, California.
You can see photos of one-wheeled basketball action on our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. From time to time in my weekly conversations with Charlie Pierce, I bring up a pseudo-sport that provokes Charlie to shout,
"Sports!"
Andrew DeFama emailed recently to bring to my attention an achievement that would no doubt elicit that response. A man from Suffolk in the UK has broken a hat trick of world records for flipping beer mats, Mr. DePalma wrote. Dean Gould flipped and caught 35 beer mats with two fingers while blindfolded, speed flipped mats 800 times in just 41 seconds, and caught 108 mats after dropping them from his elbow. So now you know that, in case anybody asks. Last week's Best Of show included a story about the Pan Mass Challenge, and that pleased Jeff Tracy, who hears Only a Game on WBFO in Buffalo. Mr. Tracy participates in a swimming event that raises money to fight cancer, which is what the bicycle riders in the Pan Mass Challenge also do. He wrote, "I wanted to tell you that the story set a tone, because the tears resurfaced during the story of you throwing out the first pitch at a minor league baseball game." Mr. Tracy, if you have any respect for baseball, the tears would really have flowed if you'd been at that ballpark in Pawtucket, Rhode Island that afternoon. Ron Abramson of Concord, New Hampshire, liked the story about the 2009 Vermont 100 race. He ran in it and wrote that he found Doug Trabue, quote, did an admirable job of capturing the essence of this incredible and inspiring event. Dave Walters, who hears the program on KPBS in San Diego, found another reason to like that story. "I loved hearing Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band's Moonlight on Vermont after that running story," he wrote. "It made my day." The inspired music selections of our senior producer, Gary Wallach, frequently elicit compliments, and sometimes we get emails with questions about the music on the program, so this seems a good time to mention that our website, onlyagame.org, includes Gary's weekly music blog, in which he identifies and, in some cases, makes excuses for his choices. Let us know what you think about anything you've heard on the program, whether or not it's musical, by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. Or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also join our Facebook friends at facebook.com/onlyagameradio and follow us on Twitter, username @onlyagame. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
A donkey named Anapka went sailing through the air. She was a Russian promo stunt, and the folks who put her there were deaf to all her braying. But others heard her plea, and the Brits who read the Sun complained, and now that donkey's free. Oh, sports can be quite cruel, it's true, and sometimes they're a bore. But the parasailing donkey gonna fly no more. So praise the Tottenham soccer coach who opened up his door to that parasailing donkey, she'll fly. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a tale of steroids and narcissism from a former Arnold Schwarzenegger lookalike. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The group led by Nolan Ryan will finally be allowed to buy the Texas Rangers. There were smiles all around from the new owners, the guy who was outbid, and the guy who filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy before putting the team up for sale. So do you agree with outgoing owner Tom Hicks that this was win-win-win?
It sounds that way. Tom Hicks, of course, the man who helped George Bush become a front man for the Texas Rangers and thus have enough money to run for president. Thanks, Tom. We'll get back to you later on that. Seems to be very happy. Nolan Ryan has managed to keep Mark Cuban out of baseball ownership, which is absolutely a terrific thing. And Nolan Ryan is on his way to being one of the great hands-on owners of all time, because he's already talking about how he's going to handle pitchers and stuff from the owner's box.
I love it.
But I also like the fact that the economics of the sport are such that you would pay almost $600 million and almost $400 million in cash for a baseball team that's bankrupt.
On Wednesday afternoon in Yankee Stadium, Alex Rodriguez became the youngest player to hit 600 home runs. Is it fair to say that while some people greeted this news by saying ho, others said hum?
Pretty much, yeah. And I'm not entirely sure it has to do with steroids or the fact that people don't like A-Rod. You know, it was buried by a bunch of other stuff. You know, it took a week and nobody followed him around very much. We'll see what happens if he gets anywhere close to 700.
I just wonder if hitting lots and lots and lots of home runs is just never again going to be what it used to be.
Well, it's what it used to be if you choose to let it be what it used to be. I mean, we're all making individual decisions on how we feel about this particular era.
A muscle tear in his right thumb has knocked Red Sox first baseman Kevin Youkilis out of the lineup for the rest of the season, which is all right, because the Sox otherwise have been healthy this year, right?
You just wonder if Terry Francona, the manager of the Red Sox, is ever going to be able to detach his palm from his forehead. I mean, it's just at this point, just have the team bus go, you know, into the river. Dustin Pedroia is not back yet. Jacoby Ellsbury just barely got back this week after the world's longest rib injuries. Mike Cameron's gone. The pitching staff has been healthy and then not healthy, and Clay Buchholz is pulling hamstrings. And now Kevin Youkilis tears a muscle in his thumb swinging the bat.
According to the NBA schedule, Charlie, LeBron James of the Miami Heat will return to Cleveland for the first time on December the 2nd. Do you think the city will be out of LeBron James jerseys by then, or will they still be burning them?
Since Cleveland is apparently, you know, declining to grow up on this issue, I suspect they'll manufacture some new ones to burn when he gets there.
In other offseason basketball news on Wednesday, Shaquille O'Neal became a Celtic. What, Boston was short on veterans?
Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy.
A great day for writers about basketball. Yes.
Oh, are you kidding? I mean, the introductory press conference, they're going to be able to sell tickets to. The question is, does he refer to himself as the big Hibernian, the big Shamrock? Which way do we go? But the Celtics, as you pointed out, have found a way to make the average age of their roster even older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, do we now start referring to Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen as, quote, the three who are not all that big anymore compared to the guy we just got?
Either that or the young fellers.
Yeah. The USA Today preseason coaches poll was released on Friday, and big surprise, defending champion Alabama was ranked number one. Boise State, last season's other undefeated team, was ranked at 5. Is this more proof that the powers that be still have no love for the Boise State Broncos?
First of all, Bill, who'd you vote for? Because I know you're a regular voter in the AP coaches poll.
I always try to vote, you know, even if it's only a local mayoral election, but somehow I missed
your
this
ballot
one.
Blew
I don't
off
know
the porch
how it
again.
Happened.
Boise State has now stepped in football into the place where Gonzaga has stepped in basketball, which is basically they are the little out of the box school that everybody votes for. They had a great year last year. They were 14-0. They beat TCU in the Fiesta Bowl. Not the most glamorous Fiesta Bowl of all time. This will be the Fisher Cut Bait year for them.
The NFL is discussing a new so-called chip-in-ball technology with a German company that has developed same. Assuming said technology is adopted, what will it accomplish?
Apparently, you will be able to determine whether the ball crosses the quote-unquote imaginary plane of the goal line. Mm-hmm. You know, the first time they use it in a rainy day, I would be reluctant to catch it. I don't know why. Maybe I'm just an old guy.
Or lightning.
Exactly.
Elsewhere in technology of sports news, the instant replay system at the Little League World Series will be updated this month. Boy, about time, huh?
Yeah, I didn't realize they had replay, but now they're going to use it on force outs, tagging a guy out if a guy missed the place or not. Exactly where actual baseball, Major League Baseball, should be using it, and Armando Galarraga would have a perfect game by now.
On Tuesday at the new Meadowlands Stadium, the U.S. men's soccer team will play an exhibition against Brazil. Before that game, the Soccer Hall of Fame will conduct their induction ceremony. Have you ever heard of a Hall of Fame welcoming inductees anywhere other than at the Hall of Fame?
No, because, you know, like the Boxing Hall of Fame, which is in Saratoga, New York, and the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, which is in Hayward, Wisconsin, the Soccer Hall of Fame is located in an obscure place out in the woods, and they want to do this before the USA men's national team plays Brazil. They've already sold 50,000 tickets for that, so good for them for piggybacking on that. My question is, Kyle Rote Jr., who I swear was the only American soccer player anybody ever heard of for about 20 years, is just getting in now?
Yeah, they just got to.
And they had the Veterans Committee to do it?
Charlie, sports fans in Philadelphia have often been tough on their teams, and not just on their teams. They once booed Santa Claus and I think threw snowballs at him as well. But would you agree with me that two guys in Philadelphia really outdid themselves this week.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to congratulate Philadelphia for putting up 20 statues of the Philly Fanatic goofball mascot all over the cities. These two guys knocked one over, apparently disemboweled it, and really did some horrible things to the Philly Fanatic. $3,000 worth of damage to the statue. I'm sure suspicion first fell on the local Chamber of Commerce, but I think they've probably got the right guys in this one.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can hear my voice each week. I bet you didn't know that I can hear yours, but that's only true if you leave a comment about the show on our listener line. To do that, please call 617-353-1860. Say steroids to most sports fans, and they think Barry Bonds, or perhaps Bud Selig in the U.S. Congress. But when Paul Solotaroff began injecting himself with steroids 35 years ago, he wasn't thinking about hitting home runs. He was thinking about impressing girls, or at least meeting one. His new book, The Body Shop, subtitled Parties, Pills, and Pumping Iron, or My Life in the Age of Muscle, chronicles, among other things, various successes along that line. Paul Solotaroff joins me now from NPR in New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, it's a pleasure to be here. And let me correct you. I, too, was thinking of home runs. In fact, I was thinking exclusively of home runs.
Okay, well, that's good, because the book might lead people to think otherwise. But you could have begun this book with a scene featuring the 98-pound weakling you used to be, but instead the Body Shop begins with an account of your bizarre impersonation of Moses. Why did you start your book with that particular recreation?
First of all, if I'd written this book in the tone and timbre of that year, it would have been the dreariest 300 pages ever set to type. And so my ambition in writing this was to essentially write the bastard love child of Boogie Nights and Portnoy's Complaint. there I am at the Weisskopf's bar mitzvah in this sheer flowing robe over one shoulder with the long gray beard that itched like goat's wool, not lamb's wool, unslept from an orgy and desperately in need of a fix. At that point, I was probably doing daily injections of decadorablin, daily injections of testosterone cypionate, which is an insane amount. And I think if my very patchy memory serves, I was also dropping Anadrol tablets. So I was in fine humor when I got there, dripping wet. And also, because I had come straight from a two-night orgy, I was still wearing the zebra-patterned G-string, and that very merrily showed through the sheer robe that they'd had made for me. So I probably wasn't the most convincing prophet.
All right, let's take a few steps backwards. In 1976, a dramatically muscled fellow student at Stony Brook introduced you to the campus gym. And you took to the weightlifting right away, but how long was it before you realized that simply lifting weights, even a lot of weights, was not going to get you where you wanted to be?
I was at Stony Brook. The year was 1976. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I weighed about 140. And Mark was two doors down and difficult to get to for the line of girls that started at his dorm room, snaked down the hallway at the fire doors and circled around the Southern State Parkway. And I'd gone up to him because I'd heard through the grapevine that he, too, had been a kind of skeletal, lonely kid just a couple of years before. And I said to him, Mark, how did you do this? And he said, well, tell me what you want. Do you want to get big or do you want to get strong? And I thought about it a second, you know, and I said, well, actually, Mark, what I really want is to get laid. Very shortly after, though, I met a guy who I call Kenny in the book, And Kenny sort of laughed at me one day and said, you really think you'll get big, you know, doing bee pollen and drinking milkshakes. I wound up shooting up that day, and within a couple of weeks, I sprouted my first cuts. This is approximately February of 76, when my father, the great Ted Solotaroff, Philip Roth's editor, Norman Mailer's editor, but a man to whom I hadn't spoken for a number of complicated Jewish reasons for several months, came out to pick me up at the end of the semester. We're talking end of May, so 4 months later. He walked up to me in the hallway and he said, excuse me, can you tell me where Paul's room is?
As your appearance was changing over the course of the next several months, was there ever a point, perhaps when you were failing to walk past a mirror, when you found yourself thinking, wow, I've become a raging narcissist?
Yeah, and whenever I'd walk by a mirror, I'd pop a bottle of champagne. I had this brand new toy of a body that was changing every day, and I just couldn't get enough of this creature in the mirror who never stopped looking like a stranger to me. And it took me a long time to really kind of incorporate, you know, to assimilate that version of me internally. And by the time I did, I was already getting sick.
Well, when you talk about getting sick, at what point did you begin to realize that your use of steroids was causing physical and also psychological damage?
Well, it was, first of all, emotional. People talk laughingly about roid rage. The rage is the least of it. You wind up becoming this kind of hair-trigger bipolar character. You find yourself weeping over Allstate commercials. you erupt when someone gives you a sidelong look on the 104 bus going downtown. You're suddenly living with the volume, the emotional volume turned all the way up.
Given these circumstances you describe, how did you stop using steroids?
Fitfully and with a great deal of failure. I had a heart attack at 22. I was profoundly insomniac. I'd gotten very paranoid. And I remember being the biggest guy on campus, walking to class and constantly looking behind me, sure that somebody was lurking. But by the time I get really sick and have the heart attack, I've got the makings of full-on panic disorder. My asthma has returned. I'm allergic to pretty much anything I'm putting in my mouth, and was the step before actively suicidal. Hmm.
In the book, you characterize the 70s as the age of muscle, and we can certainly understand that, it being Arnold Schwarzenegger's heyday. But does that make the late 80s and 90s the triumphant years of Maguire, Sosa et al., the return of the age of muscle?
No, I think what happened was the 70s were this kind of garden party of sexual innocence and chemical experimentation in which people found themselves in discos wearing hairstyles that the EPA later classified as Superfund sites. And essentially were behaving like a race of perpetual teenagers. Well, that energy really found its commodified expression in sports, such that by the time I start covering sports professionally as a journalist, I'd walk into the Oakland A's clubhouse and see utility infielders built like Roman centurions. you know, that was the team of Maguire, Canseco, Ricky Henderson. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, it's here and it's not going away.
Paul, just out of curiosity, what do you do for exercise now?
Well, even though it's completely vainglorious, I'm still in the gym four nights a week, desperately trying to hold on to that body I built, then lost, and managed somehow to rebuild in my 40s. And so ever since, I've been laboring to hold on to the remnants of that body I built as a kind of loving sacrament in my 20s.
So laboring to rebuild and hold on to that body, but presumably without chemical enhancement.
Correct, yeah. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I do know better than to go back down that road.
Paul Solotaroff is the author of The Body Shop, Parties, Pills, and Pumping Iron, or My Life in the Age of Muscle, published by Little Brown, and he joined me from NPR in New York. Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's been my pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from George Hicks. Jack Flagler is our intern, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from bodybuilder Paul Solotaroff.
I'll be back.
Yeah, well, maybe, but not before about 2020, because we are contractually limited to only one bodybuilding segment per decade. And I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.